Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Saba. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is the IRCPC call on the 4th of September 2012. On the call today, we have Alain Béranger, Hugo De Fowler, Kevin Erdman, Mikey O'Connor, Michaela Nalin, Simonetta Basaiger, Angie Graves, Barbara Knight, James Bledel, Volker Greiman, Jonathan Tenenbaum, Philip Corwin, and Roy Dykes. We have apologies from Chris Chaplow, Bob Mountain, Paul Diaz, and Marika Koenig. And from staff, we have Glenda Saint-Géry, Barry Cobb, and myself, Matthew Pogan. I would like to remind all participants to please state their names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thank you, Natalie, and welcome to the IRTPC PDT Working Group call for September 4th. And welcome back to several folks that were on vacation, as well as all of the folks in the U.S. I hope you had a nice, pleasant extended holiday. So as per our normal order of business, does anyone have any updates or declarations to be made about their statements of interest? If so, please raise your hand now. Okay, hearing none, we will then entertain any comments or additions to our proposed agenda that was circulated on the mailing list within the last 24 hours and is currently posted on the right-hand column for those in the Adobe chat room. Any updates or changes to that? Okay, I see a couple of hands. We'll start with Mikey. Mikey, go ahead.
Thanks, James. It's Mikey. I just wanted to see if I could pass on the IRTP process diagram. We had a good meeting, and we have another one scheduled for tomorrow. But until we get through that second one, we haven't really got a whole lot to report today. So I'm happy to give it another go, but I think it would be nice if we could skip it this week and pick it up next week.
Okay, and I think we have enough in the way of other materials and other items on our to-do list to cover this week, but my only question is, do you know if anything else is waiting on that diagram, or is that kind of a standalone assignment?
I'm not sure. If something comes up, I'm happy to, you know, dump it back on the screen again. It's just that, you know, we've got some puzzlers that we're working on, and rather than share all those puzzlers with the whole group, I'm hoping we'll figure them out tomorrow.
Okay. Thanks, Mikey. Appreciate the update. And what we'll do is we'll just make a note of any items that we determine that are where that diagram is on the critical path to getting those issues resolved. And, you know, maybe it's something that you can take back into your meeting tomorrow. Next up is Michaela. Go ahead.
Just very briefly, James, we could have done, I might have missed it, but have we discussed whether we're meeting in Toronto or not?
There was a brief exchange of emails, and now I'm struggling to remember if that was with the entire list or just one of the subgroups or just perhaps between staff and co-chairs, but we have allocated time in Toronto to meet for this working group. The question is whether or not that meeting will be a working group meeting, you know, a face-to-face meeting, or whether that would be, I think, ideally a presentation of our initial report to the community in Toronto. So I think that we do have the time allocated. It's just a question of how far are we along and can we use that as a presentation, or do we need it to continue to develop the recommendations? I'm hoping it's more of a coming-out party than an actual work session. Does that answer your question, Michaela?
Yeah, that's fine. Thanks.
Okay, great. Okay, so let's dive into item number three on our agenda, which is the review of the public comment review tool. And per our previous discussion, we were ready to close off the review of our comments received during the public comment forum, the response forum, and the workshop in Prague. This was circulated to the mailing list to the sound of deafening silence. So I think that we wanted to close this off during our last call, but we wanted to give everyone one final shot to make any edits or changes to this tool. So if anyone has any last-minute changes, we're going to consider this adopted here in about 5 minutes. Any other thoughts, comments, or last-minute objections? If so, raise your hand. Otherwise, we will consider this phase of our work to be complete. Okay, excellent. And I did want to note that this is an important part of the ICANN process, and I think that we did a very thorough and comprehensive job of reviewing all of the feedback received from all the various channels. So excellent work, everyone, and I appreciate everyone's efforts on that. Item number four was the process diagram that was tagged currently by Mikey. And as we discussed here just a few minutes ago, we're going to go ahead and defer that until our next meeting and capture any items that we feel are attached to that in our call today. Which brings us to item number five. And item number five is probably where we will spend the lion's share of this meeting and perhaps the next one as well, is the discussion of the remaining open questions. Handy list has been compiled by Marika and staff, and it's currently being displayed on the screen. There are 9 open questions associated with Charter Question 1, which is the change of registrant issue. There is 1 open question with regard to Charter Question 2, the FOA. And then I guess, and Barry, correct me if I'm wrong, there are no open questions with regard to Charter Question 3. Is that correct?
That's what I understand, yes.
Okay, so it sounds like we're kind of off the hook necessarily for Charter Question 3, or at least we've reached some consensus on this group as well as the within the community through all of our feedback on our initial recommendations on that issue. So we'll certainly go back and take a look in our initial report and make sure that everything jives with our understanding, but it sounds like that one's going to be the least one. So perhaps can I recommend that we start with a recommendation, with the open question on number 10, which is the only remaining open issue on Charter Question 2 or Charter Question B, which is the time limiting of FOAs. And I'll read that question out to the group. Essentially says that the working group needs to review the transfer process and how auth info codes and a form of authorization influence the transfer process as well as process differences between change of registrant and change of registrar. Starting to sound like this may touch on the diagram that Mikey and the subgroup are constructing, but I would open a queue here onto what is it exactly that we're trying to resolve. Is there a concern that the auth info code and the FOA are somehow colliding, or that that we're treating the FOA as though it is an authorization of some kind, or that I'm looking for, I guess, some clarification on the group. What is the question that we need to put on the table here? No takers. Mikey?
I'm merely rushing to fill a void because in order to really answer this question, what I really ought to have in front of me, which I don't, is the initial report.
Okay.
I can't remember what we said in there, but I know that there was pretty brisk discussion about the use of some of these codes, and since I was right in the middle of that, I think I just can't remember where we landed in the initial report as to how reusable and what the role of those codes was going to be, but I imagine that that's where this discussion came up.
That sounds familiar. Might be also sounding familiar as something that's not stated here, which is wasn't just about time limiting FOA. It was more about event event-driven changes to the FOA, so that they would expire on certain events.
Yeah. And the scope.
I don't
of
see use. That. Yeah. Maybe Simonetta can shed some light here. Simonetta, go ahead.
Well, I'm not sure if I can shed some light, but I just wanted to say that as far as I remember, there was a discussion on the lack of a definition of what an FOA is versus what an auth-info code is, and that the two are kind of like used interchangeably, that for some people, the having the ability to produce an auth-info code basically means that it that is the authorization for a transfer from one person to another. And I think maybe because of this lack of policy for this change of registrant, more or less at the same time with the change of registrar, this has kind of become the practical way to give this authorization is that you just hand someone the auth-info code and thereby enable that other person to get the transfer done. Where the FOAs, the way they're currently worded and the way they're stored, make absolutely no sense in this authorization process. Because if you read the wording of the FOA, it's really only written for a transfer that happens from the same registrant to the same registrant, from one registrar to another, but has nothing to do with giving the authority to somebody else that you allow them to now take possession of a name. So I think that all of these things together is where auth codes and FOAs and their respective roles are just completely unclear. And I think we came across this thing because they were auth info codes were basically used as the mechanism to say to someone else, here you have my okay to make a transfer on the name because de facto you can do it because you have this code. Versus what the FOAs are doing basically becomes meaningless in this process. It just becomes a click, click, click of the mouse button, but the copy of the actual FOA makes no sense in that process.
Okay. Thanks, Simonetta. I will I'll put myself in the queue here for just a second. I recall there was a some discussion and some analogies that compared the two. I would say an FOA is not meaningless, particularly in the perspective of a registry that is attempting to address or investigate or resolve a dispute, transfer dispute. I think the FOAs then become fairly important. I think that one of the analogies that we were discussing in Prague, and I didn't mean that there was agreement on this analogy, just that it was on the table, was that FOAs were the legal paper trail that established control, and that the auth-info code was the practical method that allowed someone to affect control or the password to the domain name. And so we were saying something along the lines of if domain names were a car, then the FOA would be the title or registration to that car, and that the auth-info code would be the car keys that would actually start the engine. So, you know, I could steal your car keys and drive off. That doesn't necessarily mean I own the car. I think that's kind of where we were discussing these things in Prague. I don't know that that addresses all of the issues or all of the use cases. I'm starting to think that this is one of those issues that requires a more comprehensive diagram that Mikey and the sub-team are working on. But I think that we can at least I'm not ready to say that FOAs are meaningless in these contexts because they have been used quite extensively for so long for millions of transfers. It just seems like that would be a pretty profound statement to say that that there's no use for them. Go ahead, Barbara.
Hi, this is Barbara. James, I think you put it very well, and I agree that FOAs are not insignificant here because I do agree that they are used very extensively at, throughout the dispute process, as well as, there's a lot of references to them just in the policy itself, and being able to produce, something that proves that the registrant came to their to the registrar that they want to transfer to and said, yes, we want this. Whereas the auth info code, you know, really is, it goes further, I guess, than what an FOA is, because FOAs are exclusively to deal with transfers from one registrar to another, and as Simonetta put it, you know, really relating only to a transfer of registrar versus a transfer of registrant. But that the auth info code really is the systematic, I guess, key, if you will, to being able to make changes relative to that that domain name. And while, yes, they're used to authenticate, if you will, a transfer, anytime a transfer request comes into the registries, the auth info code has to accompany that, and it has to match what's in the registry records as well in order for that transfer transaction to actually be processed. So in addition to that, it can be used for, you know, any number of things relative to the domain name. But, you know, right now they really are only being widely used to authenticate the transfers themselves. So I agree 100% with what you were saying, James, on that.
Okay, thanks, Barbara. And Simonetta has her hand up as well as putting some interesting thoughts in the chat. So, Simonetta, can you weigh in on those?
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify. I didn't mean to say that there's no use for something like an FOA. And I just want to make sure that everyone is aware that what the copy is and what it says right now really only makes sense if there is a registrar change, but not when there's a registrant change. And when you look at what you need to actually get a domain name transferred from one registrar to another, and in the case of a sale, for example, and the registrant changes both at the same time, everyone uses the auth code. Nobody has a use for the FOA in actually initiating the transfer process. Now, that there needs to be some kind of communication between the registrars and the registry around this FOA piece as well, because it's currently a part of the IRTP policy. That's true. However, I think that there's just, practically speaking, what people use to get a domain name transferred to another registrant as well is the auth code, and nobody really can use the FOAs in a way that makes sense for that process. So whatever new thing we're coming up with needs to address that the current wording of the FOAs is not good for that scenario.
Okay, so what we're saying is that we should either create a separate authorization for change of registrant or change the language of the existing FOA to account for this other use case, this change of registrant, because since there was no policy at all for change of registrant, it's not covered in the FOA. Is that correct?
That's correct, but it's not just that. It's also, I think, when we put this question or this open question item in there, we also thought about whether or not time-limiting the FOA is the way to go, or if it is better to think about time-limiting the authorization code. And I think those two, and then the lack of clarity of how these two pieces are practically used to get a domain name transferred from A to B, is where why we still have this open question. So we need to think about all these things.
Okay, thanks, Simonetta. Mikey, you're up next.
Thanks, James. I dug up the initial report and just wanted to refresh us on what we recommended. What we said in the initial report is that Section 2 of the IRTP be revised to insert a section which says, once obtained, an FOA is valid for 45 or 60, we haven't decided yet, calendar days, or until the domain name expires, or until there is a change of registrant, whichever occurs first. And then we note that there was rough consensus about that, but some said that their support was conditioned on a second recommendation, and that recommendation would be that the standard FOA is enhanced to support FOAs that have been pre-authorized or auto-renewed by a prior registrant who has chosen to opt out of that rule that we are proposing in the first part where it expires.
Yeah, they can only opt out of the time frame. They can't opt out of the other two events. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. And now let me get to the puzzler that we're working on in the diagramming group, which is that right now in a sick registry, it's relatively easy to figure out who the registrant is. And all of this language is hinging on the registrant. However, in a thin registry, that's much more difficult to do. And sort of collided with this problem when we were working on the diagrams last week, and then Avery and I are also on the Thick Who Is drafting team and had it confirmed in the initial report there that right now there's no really reliable way for registrars to exchange registrant information in a thin WHOIS environment. So we've got a brain teaser that we're working on there, and Bob has reached out to some of the registrars and has, I think, pretty much confirmed that indeed in a thin registrar environment, there's very little information exchanged about the domain except the domain itself and the FOA and the auth code and stuff like that. But there's no registrant information. So just to throw that into the hopper for consideration, maybe Michele can clarify that for us. That's it for me.
Okay, thanks, Michele. Thanks, Mikey. Michele, you're up, and you're going to fix everything for us right here, right?
No. I mean, there's just one thing to note with regard to this thick, thin registry debacle. Part of it might be resolved if the WHOIS output for thin registries, in other words, the WHOIS output that all registrars spit out, if that's standardized, which is one of the proposals on the table as part of the REA negotiations at the moment. The second thing is that, yeah, Mikey's right. At the moment, as far as I know, there's no easy way for us as a gaining registrar to exchange anything beyond the minimal data with the losing registrar. If the losing registrar's WHOIS server is offline, we can't even initiate the transfer. We don't know where to send any of the FOAs or anything like that. This isn't an issue for thick registries. So anything that would were to fix that would make life significantly easier. And while it may be resolved in a thick registry, .com and .net still account for the bulk of domains. And Rob Golding, you owe me emails. I'm going to murder you afterwards. On the FOA thing from Simonetta, I'm a bit confused by her comments. I'm confused. I mean, the key thing is that you start a transfer with an EPP key if you're transferring between registrars, and then there have to be FOAs. I mean, you cannot do a transfer without there being an FOA. So I'm completely confused as to what she's been talking about, because if she's making it sound like the FOA isn't compulsory. For a transfer between registrars, it is compulsory. So that confused me completely. Thanks.
Thanks, Michele. I think Simonetta is saying that's not exactly what she was driving at, so I'll let her respond, Simonetta.
Yeah, my question is, I understand there's FOA, so basically both and the losing registrar and the gaining registrar can and should send, based on the loss, sorry, the PEC, should send an FOA to their customer and have them confirm it. However, what I'm wondering about, and I don't know, that was my question to you, you don't actually send each other the FOA from the other side. So basically, if you're the gaining registrar, you don't send the FOA that you got from your client to the losing registrar, and or you don't get back from the losing registrar or send from the losing registrar the FOA that they collected from their customer, or do you?
That no, Simonetta, you don't. Actually. No, you don't.
So there is no exchange in that sense. There is a collection
Nobody ever said that there was. But you're obliged to ask to send the FOAs and get the answers.
Let's make sure we're, you know, trying to not talk over each other. So, okay, go ahead, Michele, and I think Simonetta, you had a question specifically for Michele, or were you asking the group?
No, for Michele, because, I mean, you said, James, that there's an exchange of FOAs, but I just wanted to clarify
there's no
exchange in the sense for... in the sense of one registrar sends it to the registry or to the other registrar, usually when there's no dispute. When there's a dispute, I understand that the registrars involved in the transfer are asked by the registry to produce the FOA and then send it to them. But regularly on any normal transfer, the only thing that is standardly always sent to the registry to initiate the transfer is the EPP code or the off code. I just want to ask if that's correct.
Yes, that's okay. Correct. I should not have or certainly didn't intend that. My understanding is that the FOA is sent to the registrant by the gaining registrar. The registrant acknowledges or grants the authorization, and then the gaining registrar retains that. Probably to never be seen by the light of day again, unless, in the rare case, that there is some sort of a dispute over that transfer. Then it is the responsibility or the obligation of that registrar to produce that authorization. But otherwise, it is just kept on file permanently. So that's my understanding. Simonetta, did you saw your hand up?
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of like point out what Rob Golding has been put in the comments in the chat, that in essence, what's then used for each transfer to tell the registry, please make the changeover, is the EPP code and not the FOA. I understand that the FOA is always asked by the gaining registrar of whoever the registrant is, and now also by the losing registrar, the notification piece. However, to actually request the transfer, what registrars are using is the EPP code. Is that correct?
I think that's correct. I think what I'm following is that, Rob, you're typing very furiously into the chat. Would you like to get into the queue, or...
Yeah, okay.
Michele, I'm going to have Rob jump the queue here if you don't mind, because he's typing, I think, and we've got a three-way conversation going on here. So, Rob, if you would, please.
Yeah, I mean, it's simply that the idea behind forms of authority and the original stuff that used to happen many, many years ago was that you had to send 10 ton of faxes backwards and forwards to VeriSign and registrars. Since the move now to EPP, realistically, the authority given to the gaining registrar is the EPP code, because without that, you can't do the transfer. The only person who should have that is the registrant, and it's generally, in our instance, the registrant who's ordering the transfer, or the registrant's agent who they've given the right to do. In terms of the yes, it can go, that's the emails that bounce backwards and forwards sent by the registry to the registrant and the admin contact saying these people have said they want to transfer the domain, is it all right? It's sent by the losing registrar. It's authorized by the registrant and it's controlled by the registry. So time-limiting FOAs, it's kind of like, how can you? Because you only get the FOA sent out when the registry tells you somebody wants to move their domain name. And the registry themselves will expire that after N days by either automatically acknowledging it or automatically denying it.
Okay, thank you, Rob. McKelly, you're up next.
Far be it from me to ever contradict Rob, but he's managed to confuse me a little bit. Registries don't send FOAs. I'm not sure why he thinks they do. I mean, they do in CCTLD world, but in the GTLD world, there are notifications that are sent by some of the registries, not all of them, and I've never sat down and actually worked out which one sent what, but they're just notifications that are sent to you as the registrar. So, for example, VeriSign sends you one to say that there's a pending transfer, which you get via email, and then you get ones from VeriSign to confirm that the transfer has completed. PIR send one or two as well. They're not as verbose. Now, when it comes to the FOA, I suppose there's two things here. If you look at the mechanics at a pure EPP level, FOAs are not part of EPP. They're not a core part of it. If you took FOAs out of the equation, EPP would still be happy. The way we've implemented it is that if we send an authorization key, when we get a request for a domain transfer to us, we send an FOA to the registrant. This has got nothing to do with, the registry doesn't come into play here. We are sending it to the registrant. If the registrant does not click on the thing to say, yes, I want to go ahead with this transfer, then we don't do anything further. It times out, it dies a painful death. We haven't had their authorization, so nothing further is sent to the registry. Now, if they do click on the thing and say, yes, they want to go ahead and do and transfer their domain to us, which, of course, I'd encourage them to do, once they've done that, then we record that we've received their authorization for the transfer, and then the stuff goes over to the registry and is communicated to the losing registrar. Now, somebody who's more expert in EPP might be able to argue with me, but that is what my understanding of it is how that would happen. And then after the 5 days, or before, since our last change to IRTP, it seems to be happening a lot faster, then the domain transfers registrars.
Lastly.
I don't know. Have I missed something somewhere? Rob?
Well, gentlemen. If I could jump in here, I see there's a lot of traffic going on in the chat here, and I think there's some discussion about the continued use or significance of FOAs in the environment where EPP is and EPP auth info codes are the standard. And I think that there is a correct observation that EPP or FOAs do not anticipate the change of registrant. So using the standard FOA as it's currently written with its current language does not fit that use case. So let's see if we can bring this in for a landing, because we've already burned more than half of our call on this one question. And shame on me, because I thought it was low-hanging fruit. But let me see if I can bring this in for a landing. So the understanding is that the FOA, which is part of our question, should the FOA be time limited? And I think that let's be careful here that our question does not say, are FOAs still useful or important, or have they outlived their purpose? Or we can certainly weigh in on those issues, but let's just make sure that we're acknowledging that we are sort of straying outside of what the charter question is asking us to do. It's not an existential question or verdict on the significance of FOAs. I don't want to sound like a bureaucrat here. I mean, but if there's an opportunity to clean things up and make it more efficient, we should. But the charter question specifically is asking about a time frame for expiring a validity of an FOA. And I think what we're saying in our initial report is there should be some time limit. That registrant should be able to opt out of time limits. In addition to time limits, there should be event-driven expirations to the validity of an FOA, such as transfer, change of registrant, or domain name expiry. So what if we narrow the discussion to just those questions that are outlined in our initial report? And I don't know if we can, but if we could, is the only question then remaining how long? How many days should an FOA be valid by default? Is that the only remaining question? If we set all of this other stuff aside and just focus on those very narrow questions from our initial report. Any thoughts on that? I mean, I see we only have 20 minutes left in our call, but I'm trying to draw a very large circle around this as much as possible and start to narrow it down a little bit. Michele, go ahead.
Keeping this simple, brief, and to the point, adding a time limit to the FOA, yes. So we add a time limit, wherever that is. They get a limit. I mean, that's the basic.
Yeah.
That's the basic question. As for the wording and all that other thing, you know, should the wording of the FOA be revised? I would say yes, in the same way that I would say that the wording of a lot of other things that are included on the that are included as part of ICANN policy should be revised, revisited from time to time. Am I saying change it? No, I'm saying it should be revisited. Thanks.
Okay, thanks for telling. I see that Rob also agrees with you with the green check mark. I propose that we address this open question thusly, and this is just me putting something on the table so we can all throw rocks at it, that we address our initial report with time limits, or FOA should be valid for a limited time, that registrants should be able to grant or opt out of that time limitation by granting a indefinite FOA or renewal FOA, however we want to phrase that, there are certain events that would cancel the validity of an FOA, such as a change of registrant or a domain name expiration, that you know, by necessity a registrant cannot opt out of, that the current language of an FOA is not appropriate for change of registrant use case, but could be revised or revisited, I think to use Michele's language, to be done so. And then the second paragraph or the second section of this issue would be a discussion of FOAs and how they're used versus ECP codes and whether or not they're still effective and whether or not they're just busy work, I think, on the part of registrars, or are they a critical piece of resolving disputes and, you know, for the perspective of registries. All of that other stuff, which I think is important, and I think that outside of the confines of this particular group, one wonders if these questions are ever asked or discussed, or if anyone ever will. I think that you know, we don't want to lose those discussions, but I don't know that outside of putting them out there as part of our deliberations, I don't know that we have a recommendation forthcoming. I mean, what is the recommendation that's forthcoming? That we should get rid of FOAs? That we change the language? You know, I don't know what we're driving at. We're saying a lot of things here, but I don't know that we're driving towards a recommendation beyond what we already have in our initial report. So that's kind of where I'm thinking we're going with this. I see that Michele has his hand up. I know Aubrey joined the call late, but I'm definitely looking for a sanity check from the co-chair here on whether she hears a consensus around some other points that I'm missing. But go ahead, McKelly.
Thanks, James. Just for the record, in case I forget to say it, but I probably keep saying it quite a few times anyway, I would be strongly opposed to removing the FOA or something similar completely, for the simple reason that I think you need to have some kind of audit trail, something more than just an EPP key to move a domain or domain name between two registrars. Because it's far, far too easy for somebody to get their hands on an EPP key, EPP key, if that was the only thing to stop a domain from being transferred but from one registrar to another. That would scare me quite a bit. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, McKelly. And I think even everyone who's been weighing in on this, including Simonetta and Rob, are saying essentially the same things in the chat. Let's preserve the FOA. Let's preserve the meaning of it by maybe perhaps addressing the language issue. I agree with you. In a world where there is no FOA, then this becomes a possession is 10/10 of the law type of an environment. You have the EPP code. You own the domain name. You know, end of sentence. And I think that, you know, we've all been around the block enough times to know that that's never the case. I think the registries would probably agree as well if they were ever put into a situation where they had to untangle some sort of a dispute. You know, they'd like to see that there is at least some documentation trail. So let's see if we can bring this in for a landing. Mikey, go ahead.
Thanks, James. This is Mikey. I kind of Simonetta just put something into the chat that I sort of want to highlight because it may be the way out of this, and that is that the puzzler that we're working on in the diagramming exercise is that at least in thin whois environments.com, et cetera, it's very difficult to figure out who the registrant is between registrars. And one way out of that is to eliminate two of the four use cases that I threw up on the screen last week and basically treat all transfers as a transfer of registrant and a transfer to a different registrar every time. And the reason that I'm suggesting that is that that way may be the way out of some of the difficulties that we've been running into. I'm not sure it's a baked idea. It's just an idea that's come into my head as I've struggled over the last few days with this puzzler over registrant identification and the tangle that it makes with thick whois, is that maybe there really are only two use cases. There's a use case where you transfer and you treat them as transfer registrar and registrant. And there's the use case where you transfer with essentially a pre-approved authorization. Now, I don't want to drag us down that in this call, but I just want to highlight that notion because that may be the way to walk us out of some of the difficulty that we've been in.
Thanks, Mikey. And I welcome any effort or any insights that can help us back away from this a bit, especially because I believe we're also teetering on the edge of another problem, which is the just general internet identity problem. When we start bringing things like validity of who is information and who knows for certain who the registrant is, and I think there's no bottom to some of those wells. So let's be mindful when we start to dance around the edge of those issues. Let's see if we can wrap this up here. As we went down this path, I think I've laid out some pretty concrete proposed path forward here. One thing that I would like to kind of put out to the group is, I think we need to cross this bridge now, sooner rather than later, is the discussion of what the default time limit should be. So let's narrow this whole discussion to, it sounds like we have very strong consensus, if not unanimous consensus, that there should be some time limit to authorization for a transfer if it's granted in advance of the transfer. And we've, I think, very clearly established that there are some things that could happen to a domain name that will invalidate any outstanding authorization, such as an expiration or a change of registrant. The default time limit, though, is still an open question, and we've got two things out there, 45 days and 60 days. And I think that we kind of need to make a decision. So I'm going to propose that, I think, and one of the commenters said this as well, please have a simple time frame that that is multiples of months. I would always prefer the shorter time frame. So I'm going to put 30 days on the table as well as 45 or 60. Does anyone have any strong opinions of why one time frame absolutely will not work of those three? I would say 45 is kind of an uneven number in terms of multiples of months or calendar months, but otherwise I guess it's acceptable. I don't want to go too far down into editorial mode here. 60 days lines up with a number of other existing grace periods, but might be considered a long time frame. I don't know. Let's take some thoughts on this here. Simonetta is correct that there was a comment, I believe, from Gavin. I may be messing that up, but someone had said something about it being just staying away from uneven or odd numbered times, so multiples of months. So, Volker says 60. Minetta says 30 or 60 would be better. And I guess I just realized we're talking about default times for how long they are valid. So I think longer is better. So I would now switch and say I'm on the side of 60 days. Because for those folks who are pre-authorizing this in an aftermarket context, they will probably want this to be as long as possible, presuming. Any other thoughts here? Simonetta, go ahead.
From an aftermarket point of view, I mean, and this was kind of what Bob and I were sharing with the group, it is important that there's this opt-out thing. So whether or not the standard, as long as the opt-out is there, is 30 or 60 days, we don't care as much. But I like Volker's point to say make it 60 so that it is something that people are already familiar with. I think if there's like different time frames for different things, people get confused. And if it's one thing only, then maybe there's less confusion around this is for this and this is for something else.
Okay, so I think what we're hearing from aftermarket is as long as there's a robust mechanism for opt-out, the time frame is irrelevant. And then I think there's a general agreement from Volker that 60 days lines up with other grace periods, and then there's the sentiment that I raised that longer is probably better. But I think we're starting to, you can kind of see the little slider kind of slide over to the 60-day thing. Mikey, tell us why that's a great idea or why it won't work.
I'm going to just raise another dimension, and that is that one advantage to 30 days is that it doesn't line up with the lock. If it turns out that we arrive at a lock, or whatever we call it, and the lock is 60 days, it might be useful to have the FOA be shorter than that so that it can't be used to transfer the domain post-lock. So, in fact, I certainly understand the clarity, ease of use, consistency argument, and I don't feel terribly strongly about this. But there might be a security advantage in having the FOA be shorter than the lock period so that if there's a bad guy involved, the domain is still trapped in the registrar after that FOA has expired.
An interesting, I'm going to have to noodle on that one, Mikey, but I think it's an interesting point.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, I don't know that that's
especially,
right.
Especially when you consider, and I'm just shooting from the hip here a little bit, as I suspect we all are, but especially when you consider that that lock that you're referring to is optional. It doesn't really strike me that that would necessarily be any kind of extra protection in all cases, just certain cases. So I think that sort of diminishes the security value that I do agree with you exists, but only exists in those cases. Simonetta, go ahead.
I still need to think about this some more too, but if the lock is there because the registrant has changed, wouldn't that be one of the use cases where we would say that FOA becomes expired anyway? And or the other one was if the lock is there because the domain name has changed registrar, then that was the other use case where we said the FOA becomes, it has expired. So I don't know if let's say someone actually hijacked the name and moved it from A to B and then has control over the name and at the new registrar, I don't think it matters for if it's 30 or 60 days for a new FOA because unless the old registrant realizes that the domain is no longer there, the new registrant would just go ahead and create a new FOA anyway without anyone else ever noticing.
And I don't want to speak for Mikey, but I thought that I understood he was referring to the existing reasons for denial after domain name is first created or after an initial previous transfer, where a registrar can deny a new transfer if it's within 60 days of an old transfer, even setting aside the other discussion locks, discussion of locks after a change of registrant. So I don't know, Mikey. I think that there is some benefit there, as you discussed, in terms of security, but I think it's very situational. Is that the right word I'm looking for? It doesn't cover all the use cases. And so I think I want to say tip of the hat to you for pointing that out, but I think that that's still scale is still tipping in the direction of 60 days, just because of the simplicity and the alignment. Any other thoughts on this one, folks? And I guess I'm looking to Aubrey here. Like the thriller movies from the Cold War, I see like we both have a missile key here when we're trying to detect whether or not there's a consensus. Looking to make sure that you feel like we're going down the right track here, or should we do this on the mailing list to make sure that we're covering all those folks who don't regularly attend calls? What are your thoughts, Aubrey?
Okay, yeah. Sorry I've been quiet. I'm sure that you are appropriately calling for this conversation, but since I missed the first 20 minutes, until I go back and listen, or I missed the first 25 minutes, It's hard for me to personally say, yes, I heard that too. What I recommend doing is basically writing that up, sending it to the list, and then at the beginning of our next meeting, or maybe at the end of our next meeting, no, at the beginning of our next meeting, just checking on it and making sure. And in the meantime, I'll listen and have my own opinion. I've spent most of this meeting trying to catch up with the discussion from what was still being said, and as I say, I'm sure you're right, but I didn't hear it.
Okay, so that's a good approach, and I think that'll also capture, we have a number of apologies this time around, so it's possible that we've overlooked something. So maybe Barry and I can write up this question and get that out to the list here today or early tomorrow. Mikey?
This is Mikey. As I said in the chat, it would be extremely helpful if some of you folks who really get the use of all of these FOAs and auth codes could join us on this use case call tomorrow, which will start an hour earlier than this call started for you, but tomorrow morning. Because, quite frankly, I am pretty bewildered. Yeah, I can send emails. That's a good idea, McKaylee. I think that the use case discussion and this FOA EPP discussion, I had no idea they were so intertwined, but as I listen to this, they're actually quite intertwined, and so we could use a little more expertise on that call. Again, if the call started at 1200 for you today, it would start 1100 tomorrow is when we're planning that call. And maybe what we need, Barry, could you get a full-blown call set up for that? Last time we just did it on Bob Mountain's infrastructure, but we might be better off with a full-blown bridge and the Adobe room so that people can join.
Okay, I'll work with Natalie for that.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Mikey, and yes, thanks for Barry for expanding that as much as possible and getting the broadest possible participation. That'll do it for this episode, folks, and shame on me again for thinking that we could just knock out that one issue as low-hanging fruit, and that would leave the other nine for our next call. At this pace, I'm concerned that we'll be doing this until middle of next year, so we'll probably have to find a way to make sure that we've got some concise capturing of all the different questions so that we can get them addressed as much as possible on the list so that the calls are just made for a thumbs up, thumbs down consensus test. We'll be looking for some increased participation tomorrow. I will make it as possible. Look for that email. Just keep moving forward on these, and we'll tackle these open questions 1 through 9, as well as just close off our button-up number 10 on our next call, which is 1 week from today. And thanks, everyone. Please keep an eye on the mailing list for further updates. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks, James. Thanks, Aubrey. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much, Trevor. You may now stop the recording.